drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. Over the last year, COVID-19 has changed the world and our day-to-day experience of it. And most of us will be happy, very happy, to see the other side of this. You know, to get back to normal life, whatever that might look like. But any major event like this has the potential to reshape the world. So what lessons should we learn from this time and what changes are worth hanging on to? Sophie Cousins is a journalist and a writer. Her latest book is called Renewal, Five Paths to a Fairer Australia. And she's my guest in the drawing room. Sophie, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with your own story. What, you were in Kathmandu when you first heard about COVID?
Yes, I was. Well, actually, I was on holiday in Ecuador and I was on a climbing trip with some friends and some bits of news was popping up about this virus that had broken out in Wuhan, and I didn't really think much of it. And so I flew home back to Kathmandu. And within 2 weeks, it became pretty clear that this was a very, very serious virus. And borders started shutting. And I recall ScoMo was saying that the borders are going to shut and any Australian who wishes to come home should get home. And in Kathmandu, the Nepali government was also making it pretty clear that it was also going to shut its borders. So I managed to get on the last flight out of Kathmandu and made it back to Australia just in time, let's say. So, yeah, I was home for almost 6 months, which was a whirlwind because I haven't spent any time in Australia in 10 years, really.
Yeah, that's incredible. So what was it like, that mad rush to get home?
Oh, my gosh. So the plane flew out of Kathmandu and it landed in Kuala Lumpur. And when we got off the plane in Kuala Lumpur, we were just walking around and everything was shut. And you just looked at the board of all the flights, of all the departing flights, and everything cancelled, 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 cancelled. And it seemed that basically the only flight getting out of there was the one to Sydney. And we had about a six-hour layover, and there was one bar that was open in the centre of Kuala Lumpur Airport, and so it was just basically a bunch of about 400 Aussies drinking beer, singing the national anthem and Kylie Minogue songs and all these other Aussie songs. And, I mean, we were just we weren't really sure what was happening, and it was just crazy. And I also kind of anticipated that I may be home in Sydney for maybe a month or two. So I'd packed a bag of just, you know, a couple of books and a few changes of clothes. And little did I know that I wouldn't actually be returning home for 9 months. So it was quite a crazy experience. And one I must say that I'm still kind of coming to terms with.
Yeah, that's right. When everything changes so quickly, it's hard to get your head around. You've been living and working overseas for most of the last decade, as you said. What was it like returning home? What did the country look like after your time away?
To be very honest, the longer that I've spent out of Australia, the harder it has been to return home. I still very much feel Australian in my blood, but I don't know. It really made me think of how do you define home and where is home? And, you know, my family is in Australia and, you know, some of my closest friends are in Australia. I grew up there and it very much feels like home, but it's a question that I continue to grapple with. And going home and spending that time there during the beginning of a pandemic was a life-changing experience. And I'm really grateful to have spent the time with my family there and to be able to go through the experience that we went through in Australia. And also, I mean, what a privilege to belong to a country that responded in such an incredible way to the pandemic. And for the last 6 months, I've been back living overseas, and it feels like a different world when we look at, you know, the lockdowns that have happened in Sydney and Melbourne and Perth. You know, we have one case in Perth and the city goes in lockdown, and then you look and you go, well, oh my gosh, look at the rest of the world, and you can't even compare. It's just, yeah, it's been a whirlwind.
In some ways, it sounds like you're approaching Australia as an outsider as well as an Australian. Was that where the idea for the book began?
It did. So I came back to Australia and I was fortunate enough to get a grant from National Geographic to go into some Indigenous communities in remote and rural areas and to really look at how they were preparing for the pandemic. Because at the beginning in February and March, you know, we were thinking, oh my gosh, we were thinking worst case scenario. I mean, this is going to spread across the whole of the continent, and what is this going to look like in places that are really disadvantaged? And thankfully, you know, the worst case scenario didn't happen. So I had started writing some pieces, and my editor at Text Publishing picked up a couple of them, and she got in touch with me and she said, hey, what do you think about writing a book on the pandemic? And it was such a grounding experience, because to come home and to not have spent a significant amount of time in Australia, I think it could have felt quite isolating, but the book project really allowed me to get back in touch with the country and to go off and explore. And I was fortunate enough to spend quite a lot of time in Wilcannia, an Indigenous community about 9 hours out of Sydney, and I did some other travel around Australia, and it was such an amazing project to be part of. But I think I perhaps was able to view the pandemic and issues ongoing in Australia. I guess I take a different perspective.
Tell me about Cyril Hunter. What did you find when you met Cyril?
So Cyril Hunter is an elder who lives in Wilcannia, and I went to meet him by the river, and he had moved his family to the river in anticipation of COVID spreading. And he, from memory, I think he's in his late 70s, and he just said, you know, if COVID comes into Wilcannia and spreads throughout this community, we're all dead. And so he had taken his community, set up camp by the river, and I went down and I just spent some time talking to him, and they had these socially distanced tents where you would enter and you would wash your hands and you would sanitize and you would distance, and we would sit a couple of meters apart and we'd have a chat about his life and what it was growing up in, what it was like growing up in Wilcannia and life on the river, and how this experience had basically brought him back to the bush, and he was teaching his nieces and nephews and the rest of his extended family what it was like for him. And then we had a couple of days going out and looking for emu. We went emu egg hunting, and it showed me how integral being connected to nature and your environment is in Australia. And I think when you live in a city, we're very disconnected from that.
On RN, I'm Patricia Carvelis. Sophie Cousins is my guest in the drawing room, and we're talking about her new book, Renewal. You point out that Australia's Indigenous people were disproportionately affected by H1N1, the swine flu pandemic that reached Australia in 2009. But that hasn't been the case this time round. What changed this time?
Well, this time round, the communities that needed to be involved in the response were involved, and they were the ones at the forefront of the response. They were out there even in January, before the first case of coronavirus had landed on our shores. They were out there translating health messages into languages all across Australia, educating people on this virus, because they knew that this was a virus that could literally, potentially wipe out whole communities. And that is what we have seen in the US and Canada and other countries that have large Indigenous populations. And this time they were involved in the response, not just at the community level, but at the state and federal level. And I think from a whole, this whole experience, it's brought into question the whole close the gap. So the pandemic has reminded us to ask questions about Australia. For example, why are Indigenous children 17 times more likely to be in prison than non-Indigenous youth? Why does trachoma, an eye disease that has been wiped out in almost every country on the planet, why does that exist in remote Indigenous communities while other Australians are spared? Why do Indigenous people die almost 10 years earlier than non-Indigenous Australians? Why? And I think the pandemic has forced us to ask, why does this gap exist in the first place?
That community involvement, is that something specific to this moment, specific to the pandemic, or are there broader lessons that we should take from it?
I think there's, Patricia, I think when we talk, when we talk about the pandemic, I think this has just reiterated the importance of community. When we look at mutual aid that has spread across Australia, it has reiterated the importance of community. And I really hope that the lessons we've learned from the pandemic continue to inspire community movements. And I think when we talk about change, I really believe that change begins at the grassroots level. It begins within communities, and so much can be achieved at the community level.
You write about other ways that individuals and small communities have been making a difference. Tell me about Manpreet and Monica.
So Monica was another incredible person that I met in Wilcannia who set up a Meals on Wheels service during the pandemic. It was at a time where basically people were too afraid to leave their homes. And Manpreet was is a migrant from India, and he came to Melbourne to study, and he went on to help his community, and he served meals to a wide range of people. And I mean that their stories are not unusual, and by that I mean these are stories that we find in our own backyard of incredible people doing incredible things, and they show the impact that we can have in our own backyard, that we don't need to be reaching for the stars in terms of our impact. If you can help a neighbour, if you can help a friend, if you can spare some time for others in need, you can have such an impact. And I think those lessons can reverberate and they can continue on, and they can expand. I think the pandemic has showed us the importance of community and of engaging with the people around us.
But not every community will have a Manpreet or a Monica or a Cyril. How do you expand that idea out? How do you create more community involvement, which is one of the big things you're advocating for?
I think every community can have a Monica or a Manpreet, and probably already does, but we're not aware of it. I think, when we're talking about engagement in community, one should feel that they are represented and their voices are heard. And so in my book, I talk about kind of different modes of engagement. And I still believe at the community level, even having conversations with people, even setting up food co-ops or walking to school with a bunch of kids and parents meeting, I still believe that is one of the greatest ways to engage people to then kind of move on to a bigger scale. So, yes, I think every community has a Monica or a Manpreet, or actually has many of them, and we're just not aware of it.
Every community in Australia is really diverse, and many people wouldn't agree with all of your solutions, nor you theirs, of course. How do you balance that out?
I definitely am not going around saying I have the solutions to all the problems that we have. I'm not a political analyst. I'm not an economist. I'm not a scientist. I'm a writer. I've come home and I've asked myself the question, what type of country do I want to belong to? What type of country do I hope my family, you know, will belong to, not just now, but in the future? And how can we create, you know, a safer, more sustainable, better, fairer, more equal, healthier, secure, smarter Australia? So I guess I'm definitely not proclaiming that I have the solutions to our problems, but what I'm hoping to do with this book and by talking about issues is just basically broadening people's imaginations and getting them to see that there are alternatives and that we are in a position to do better. And we are an incredibly, incredibly privileged country, and we do have the means to do better. That is what fills me with such hope and optimism.
It feels like a lot of things are slowly returning to the way they were, in Australia at least, because we've been able to suppress this virus. And I imagine for most people there's a lot of relief in that. Do you think there's a desire for change?
That's a good question. It's been interesting because in the last 6 months I've moved into different spaces where it's almost been in the midst of a pandemic, post-pandemic, pre-pandemic. So I look back at Australia and look at, you know, like you said, we've suppressed the virus, we've done incredibly well in dealing with it. And does that mean that because we haven't, you know, in inverted commas, suffered as much as, you know, countries in Europe or the US, for example, does that mean we don't have the desire for change? I don't believe that to be true. I think there is a desire for change. And I think what the pandemic has done is, at least for some people, not all, is made us kind of sit back, take a breather, and to think about what we want from life. What are our values? What are our, you know, what are our goals? What type of country do we want to belong to? So I think there definitely is scope for change. How we define that change, I'm not sure. But I feel at least we're having conversations, and we're having conversations about issues that we probably not talking about on the scale that we're talking about today.
Before I let you go, you're based in Afghanistan at the moment, though we're talking to you from Mexico. What has COVID been like in that country?
Afghanistan is a place where people simply do not have the capacity to take on the burden of a virus. In Kabul, we are facing multiple bombings a day. The peace process between the Afghan government and the Taliban is stagnant. People feel that they have no hope. Poverty has increased drastically. The economy is in a really bad place. Different NGOs and UN agencies are leaving the country for fear of the deteriorating security situation and COVID. So coming here, you believe that the pandemic is not really a part of people's lives, purely for the sake that they just don't have the capacity to take it on. That said, you know, that is not to say that COVID does not exist here. It does. I reported recently from the biggest coronavirus hospital in the country, and the ICU was full. And like you said, today I'm in Mexico for a couple of weeks, and whilst we were walking the streets this morning, there were people lining up to buy oxygen because the city has run out of oxygen. So we are very much still in a pandemic, and a vaccine is, it's not a quick fix for places like Mexico and Afghanistan and India and Nepal and the UK and the US. It's going to take a very, very long time, and there will be no returning to normal. The world has changed, and perhaps it's not changed as much in Australia as it will elsewhere, but it's changed and it will continue to change for a long time.
Thank you so much for joining me. It's been a really, really fascinating conversation, Sophie.
Thank you very much for having me, Patricia.
Sophie Cousins has been my guest in The Drawing Room, and her new book, Renewal, Five Paths to a Fairer Australia, is out now through Text Publishing.